Welcome to the New York Skies Astronomy Seminar for 2024, May 3. And I be the very John Pasmino. Our subject today is, where do stars come from? Meaning, the origin, the creation, and the birth of stars. Make sure you have the two files. In addition to the narration you're listening to, you need the illustrations contained in the video file. If you're missing that file, stop at www.nyskies.org. Among the jump words at the top of the home page, punch on audio video files. On this AV files page, skip the text because I'm explaining that to you now. Scroll down near the bottom. You see links to all of our seminars. And you're looking for, near the bottom, where do stars come from? There are two files you must download. Well, one you presumably already have. That's the MP3 file. The other one is the PPT file, and that has the slides and illustrations. Pull that down. When you do that, fire up the PPT file. It's a PowerPoint presentation. And then come back and play the narration again. All right, you all ready? Good. We're standing on slide one. And this is the answer for the quiz I gave you last time. That was the session about proper motions. I gave you a segment of a star catalog and asked that for the five or so stars in that segment, using the other information presented in that catalog, that is the various parameters of the stars, compute the tangential or transverse velocity, the true or space velocity, and also the angle of attack, the direction in space relative to the sun that the star is moving. And actually, all the replies I got had answers which were either spot on or reasonably close, depending on the calculator you're using and any rounding you did. So the results are what we have in slide one. You have for each star the relevant parameters. You got the distance, and you have the proper motion, and you have the position angle, which we didn't use in the quiz, and you have the radial velocity, and then there's a vertical bar. Then on the right of that bar are the three calculated quantities, V10 and V true and A, that is tangential velocity, true velocity, and attack angle. And then you can, if you want, go back to your own figures and see how close you came. I used this particular catalog from the Observer's Handbook because it gave the proper motion as a complete amount, a so-called diagonal value, instead of the two components, east-west and north-south. So this simplifies the computation and it relates better to the diagram of space and true motion within the lesson. Okay, so let's move on to slide number 2. This is the title slide, and it summarized the AV files page in the reverse order. A friend of yours may have come on to somehow the pictures slides, which by themselves don't make much sense. So this title slide tells you you need the narration and instructs you to go to the AV files page and download the MPEG-3 file. Having one and not the other is a kind of a gibberish presentation. There are no supplementary readings for this session because the literature in astronomy is pretty deep for the creation of stars, formation, birth, origin of stars. But what I'm doing for you here is summarizing some of the technical aspects and pointing out a couple of interesting side topics which relate to the creation of stars. I must tell you that star formation as an area of study in astronomy is a very active and dynamic. It is not a cut and dry system the way, say, astrometry is. I mean, until you get better instruments, you're not going to improve your astrometry. But here, observations, particularly with radio astronomy and with the new Webb infrared space telescope, are finding new interpretations, new features, new details of stars during their gestation before they actually become full-fledged stars. We call them protostars. I also will kind of skip over trying to give you the exact nomenclature for different stages within the formation of a star. It's a little inconsistent, and astronomers that I've spoken to sometimes differ. So I'm probably going to consistently say protostar, that is, from the time a object in space becomes a candidate to be a star to the time it actually ignites and becomes a star, are probably called protostar. So much for the title slide. Stepping over to figure 3, we have an all-sky view. I don't know when the author took this picture, but it's a winter sky scene, and a little below center is Orion. You see the belt stars and even the sword with the nebula. And you can jump off from Orion in different directions and pick out the other constellations. Now, stars were really, until the 20th century, assumed to be permanent features in space. They always existed. They always will exist. The major difference is that a few were found, actually about 1,000, were found to be fluctuating or varying in brightness. That was the so-called variable stars. And many of them, before we applied photography, showed proper motion. A few appeared to die because they exploded. Although we call them new stars or novae stellae, we thought that was the end state of a star. It somehow detonated and then there's nothing left. But by the 20th century, especially with advances in mass and energy, with the Einstein theory, quantum mechanics, thermodynamics, black body radiation, we started to realize that the stars are emitting energy at a prodigious rate. And since the stars appear to be isolated units in space with no obvious continuous delivery of fuel, they must have a onboard finite source of energy which they turn into light and heat. And therefore, somehow that must have been loaded with the energy source and somehow ignited, and that eventually they will die when the fuel source runs out. So the emphasis of our presentation here is, how did stars create and then become burning, shining, luminous dots in the sky? And actually, the formulation of a theory or a description of how stars are born is the confluence and intermingling of several parallel other developments in the profession. One, especially since the telescope, let's say since 1700, we started to recognize that in space there are agglomerations of stars where there seems to be a pile or heap, cumulus, of stars, which in English we call clusters. And we also were seeing misty patches of a totally unfathomable nature, which often had stars attached to them or embedded within it. And so we have nebulae for the hazy patches in English, and, well, it's the Latin word, and in many European languages, cumuli, or cumulus in the singular, for clusters. I remember when I went to Colombia, South America, the host astronomy club for our group gave us a little stargazing list, including star clusters in the southern part of the sky, which we don't see from New York. And they translated, say, from one of their own observing guides into English. And when they saw the term cumulo, which is how they say bunch or group of stars, and looked up in the Spanish to English dictionary, it was re-translated as pile or heap. And so the stargazing list mentioned NGC such and such, a heap of stars, locale such and such, a heap of stars. But we noticed them in the 1700s, and of course you, most of you are familiar with Messier in France and Lacaille in the southern hemisphere, who mapped out the stars and made special note and drawings or descriptions of these nebulae and cumuli, and often noted that this nebula has stars mixed in it, this nebula does not, and this cluster of stars has missed around some of the stars. And in the 20th century, the discovery of more of these was facilitated by photography. The register of very, very dim light on film, which can be exposed for many minutes, or, well, in those days, hours, would record images which you could not see by the eye, whose exposure time is in the order of a 15th of a second, which is to say, every 15th of a second, your eye records another image of the scene. That's why when you swish your head back and forth, or you see something moving fast like a ball in sports or racing, the image looks smeared. So the discovery of more and more of these nebulae, and more of them being inhabited by stars, which look like clusters if the nebula wasn't there, gave a very curious idea. But why would these stars be stuck in these clouds of, well, we didn't really know what, but it looked like smoke. And at other times, the cluster had only a little bit of this smoky material, and certain other clusters seem to have none at all. And we see some nebulae with only a few stars, and other nebulae with no stars. And so we were laying out on a table pictures, and we sort of shuffled them around, and there appeared to be a progression from pure nebula to nebula with a couple of stars, to nebulae with lots of stars, to clusters with lots of nebula, to clusters with a little bit of nebula, all the way out to pure clusters. We also were learning more about thermodynamics, quantum theory, black body radiation, and realized that the stars had to be radiating in the way that the sun does. Well, we didn't know what the sun was, but the stars reasonably are suns, S-U-N-S, seen far away, and the sun was a star seen close up. Pictures 4, 5, 6, and 7 illustrate, not in a progressive order, but just hopscotching around the sky, at nebulae with clusters associated with them. And actually, there's a hell of a lot of these which are favorite targets of visual observing or photography among us home astronomers. I call particular attention to slide 7. Slide 7 shows the Eagle Nebula, M16, and I note that it shows the Pillars of Creation. If you ever seen pictures of them, which the Hubble got good close-ups of, they are in fact visible in this picture, kind of in the middle of the frame. They look sort of like fingers extending upward. And this is part of your quiz. Now, every picture from the 1990s through today of the Ego Nebula, which is massaged to bring out the pillars of creation. What is your quiz? Go to any references you want, with old magazines, old textbooks, old posters. You may have to go to a older member who has ancient literature from before 1990. That's important. 1990 earlier, that is up through the 1980s. Now, I'll explain in a minute why. You may want to go to the local observatory in your library or college library, or if you're in a large town, go to the central branch of its library and pull down old books on astronomy, textbooks, picture books, collections of photographs, and look at the images of the Eagle Nebula, M16. It's a very favorite photographic target. And I'm going to ask you, do they show the pillars of creation? And would it have been possible for an astronomer looking at the picture and say, hey, wait a minute, there's something funny about that. Let me see if I can get a better picture, a closer up view. Or would they simply have been passed up as another wisp of smoke in that nebula? So that's your quiz. So it's a little bit of an Easter egg hunt, and it may not even have a definite conclusion. But that's an effort I'd like you to make. Now, why did I say before 1990? Okay. Before 1990, all astronomical observations, that the optical photograph was done from the ground under our atmosphere using chemophotography and using passive optics. That is, however the photons got into the telescope, that's what we had to work with. And also pretty much a non-massageable or non-manipulable image frozen on a glass plate, or for home astronomers, a photographic emulsion. After 1990, okay, we launched Hubble outside the atmosphere. The first major, and still is the only major, optical observatory in space. We built supersized telescopes, I think beginning with Keck, and there are many others down in Chile and elsewhere in the southern hemisphere, and in Hawaii. We developed digital imaging, where the images can be massaged and manipulated and processed electronically in ways that would be essentially impractical on chemofilm. We developed better computer, well, because the image is digital, you can send it into computers to use various analytical software, and we also have far better spectrometry, also digital photometry also. So that breakpoint about 1990 enabled us since then to show the true nature of the pillars of creation. That is, Hubble, I guess, was the first to look at M16 and having perfect atmosphere, better optics, good imaging, and so on and so forth, revealed the true character of those little wispy fingers. Also, to get away from the atmosphere problem while we stay underground, we develop adaptive optics, which for the most part eliminates the shimmer and twinkling, so that many telescopes on the ground today equal or exceed Hubble in the optical wavelengths in imaging space. So that's why I'm asking you to restrict yourself to material prior to 1990 and see if the images of M16 might have sparked the curiosity and at least an effort, even if it was unsuccessful, to see what the hell are those little finger-like prongs. That's the Earth quiz. That's in figure 7. In 8 is a piece of the summer Milky Way where the author labeled many deep sky targets. And in the summer Milky Way, we usually look at nebulae because even from New York City, we actually can see the nebulosity around many of the embedded clusters. The winter sky, we really don't have that so easily. Certainly the Orion Nebula has it. M78 doesn't have any cluster associated with it, at least in small scopes. And the Rosette Cluster, the nebulosity is a little bit too thin to punch through city sky normally, and the nebulosity around the Pleiades, where I myself have seen on occasion the bit surrounding the star Merope, but otherwise the summer sky, because you're looking toward the galactic center where there seem to be a lot more nebulae, is where we get the chance to see the pictures of nebulae and stars. And you might even have a little hopscotching around and comparing the proportion of stars to nebula in these and others which happen not to be labeled parts of the Milky Way. As the 20th century rolled along, by the 1920s we realized better the shape of our own Milky Way galaxy, and toward the middle of the 1920s we found that spiral nebulae, such as the one in Andromeda, really were whole other Milky Ways. So the 1920s coming into the 1930s was the rise of galaxy-based astronomy. So in slide 9, we see a swath of the Milky Way in the top part of the picture, and you see all the nebulosity. Now, it's very often called gas dust because gas is roughly transparent. It's thick. It does absorb. You go 1,000 or more light years of depth of gas, which is basically hydrogen and mixture of helium, you'll get an absorption, a kind of fog. But it's the dust, which is made of elements other than hydrogen and helium, and often also molecules will absorb light like a smoke, and therefore that's where you get these crenellations and curlicues and whatever along the Milky Way band. But because we now understand that we live in a Milky Way galaxy, which at least by analogy resembles the one in Andromeda, we realize that in the lower right picture, that Andromeda, seen close up, as in this picture here, has a structure very similar to the upper one within our own Milky Way. So that reasonably we're going to have, and we certainly prove this with better instruments and of course space-based imaging, that the Andromeda Galaxy and a hell of a lot of others out to several tens of millions of light years have clusters and nebulae mixed together the way we have in our Milky Way. The predominance of galaxies displaying this are spiral galaxies, because there's a distinct zone, the spiral arms, where we get this commingling of dust and gas and stars, whereas in the nucleus there's little dust and therefore perhaps not the same conditions which might lead us to think stars might be formed there. In the lower left, we see a diagram. Don't worry about the titles. Many of these slides were made for other purposes, so some of the titles may not match my narration, but the image itself was useful, and so I just use it there. We say OB group, whatever, forget about that. The little dots represent areas where we are finding specifically a nebula associated with stars, or a cluster with just residual nebulosity. And we are seeing there three spiral arms. The upper right one is the farther out. It's the spiral arm outside of our own. It would correspond roughly to the foremost one in the lower right picture of the Andromeda Galaxy. And we call that the Perseus arm because it happens to include the constellation Perseus, which is in the direction opposite to the galactic center. The inboard arm on the lower left is the Sagittarius arm because it is in that direction towards Sagittarius, in the direction of the galactic center. What you saw in the previous slide is mostly the segment of the Sagittarius arm between us and the galactic center. We ourselves, the solar system, are embedded in the middle arm called the Orion arm. Now, if you do galactic astronomy, or you like to study the Milky Way as a home astronomer, the names of these arms will differ somewhat, and you'll come across terms like the Cygnus arm, the Carina arm, the Centaurus arm, the Cassiopeia arm, and so on. But just know that for optical astronomy, we're limited to our own arm, out to a couple thousand light years, and to the adjacent inboard or outboard arms. Radio astronomy and infrared astronomy can penetrate the obscuring dust, and we can map out larger zones of our Milky Way and the inner reaches of dust-filled other galaxies. See, but it seems to be that the mix of gas dust and stars prevail in the spiral arms of spiral galaxies. We also find them in what we call irregular galaxies. That's the hopper into which we call galaxies which are not spiral, and they are not elliptical, which is to say, just a nucleus with no spiral arms. And there's an intermediate type called barred spiral, where you have a spiral arm structure that penetrates through the core to the other side and then spread out into new spiral arms. So if it's not one of those nice, neat, geometrical, beautiful pictures, but it's just a mishmash of star dust and gas, we call it irregular. And in there, we do see this intermingling and close association and jiving of gas dust and stars. The illustrations in 10 and 11, I cut myself from a planetarium software. The horizontal line, starting with slide 10, is the galactic equator, which is off like the midline of the Milky Way band in the sky, and many stars, the brighter ones, are labeled. This shows like the northern part of the Milky Way band, corresponding roughly to the winter Milky Way. The little green squares are open nebulae. No, you're not going to see these in small telescopes, except maybe one or two. I just told the program, dump your database of open nebulae onto the star chart, and that's what I came up with. While there are a couple which are a little ways off the Milky Way, almost all are very tightly aligned with the Milky Way band. Now, noting the previous picture in 9 and then also in 8, this makes a bit of sense. We, our sun, solar system, are within the spiral arm of our galaxy. The Milky Way band in the sky is the edge-on view of the spiral arm we're in and which we are surrounded by. That is the Perseus arm outside and the Sagittarius arm inside. The arms are reasonably thin, they're only about a couple of thousand light years in thickness, and we're kind of in the middle. So if we look perpendicular to the plane of the galaxy, we go straight off into empty space, and we don't see very many stars, and not too many nebulae or clusters. So that's why you get that beautiful tight alignment of open nebulae relative to the Milky Way. Now, open nebulae come in different names, and authors will use what he thinks is best. Some are called reflection nebulae, and they are mostly or contain dust, which simply reflects the light of the stars embedded in them. Some are called emission spectrum. They are gas, or mostly gas, and the light of the stars in them fluoresces the atoms of that gas. They're sometimes called diffuse nebulae because they have a fluffy, disorganized shape. They're often called bright nebulae because they're made luminous, reflection or emission, because it has stars in it. And there are many which are called dark nebulae because they are seen by silhouette against a brighter background but they have no stars of their own to make them shine. So I just gave up on trying to categorize all these nebulae that way, but they are all in the realm of open nebulae, in analogy to the classification of clusters as open. So that is my run for open nebulae. If you hop to slide 11, I have the view for open clusters. They're the little stippled circles, and while there are some which are a little away from the Milky Way, as gauged by the star configuration of constellations, the great bulk of them are right along the Milky Way band. Actually, when we do the seasonal preview of the stars, like we did in the spring, and which we'll do in June for the summer, I show all sky pictures of the same type, except at the horizon, and I show the correlation with open clusters, globular clusters, and galaxies, and why they have the preference for visibility in certain seasons and not others. But if you want open clusters, look along the band of the Milky Way whenever by date and hour that is in high sky. So there seems to be some linkage astrophysically between clusters and stars. Now, within a nebula, the gas dust is not a static, frozen structure, but it has circulation within it. If you look at an ordinary cloud in the sky, you look at it carefully, or better yet, with binoculars, you see that the material in it tumbles and rolls along and slides about and accumulates in spots and spreads out in others. And the same occurs in gas dust in deep space. Now, of course, the cloud in our atmosphere is influenced by being surrounded by air, which has a frictional and viscous effect, and probably also its own convection, and of course it's under the influence of gravity from the ground. In space, any influence is either from surrounding clouds of gas and dust, and by internal gravity. Hence it is reasonable to suppose, and this was hinted at in the late 1930s as we started to study nebulae more carefully, especially since we see that they're a feature in other galaxies, that there are denser parts and lighter parts, and the denser parts apparently are little agglomerations. Now some of these will, by the surrounding gravitational field, tear apart and dissipate, but many others seem to be small enough to be self-coherent. In slide 12, we see in one of the summer nebulae, M20, that there are denser parts here and there which appear to be holding together. Now the contours were part of images which were assembled from optical and radio observations, especially since World War II, when radio astronomy actually emerged as a separate discipline. 1948 is often the zero point year, because that, I think, was the first year that a specific radio receiving station was built for astronomy purposes, as opposed to being a J-rig from World War II surplus electronics. And they could map out nebulae in a way that optical astronomy could not, but the two could be correlated together. And often in early textbooks of the 1950s, we see an optical picture and superimposed, the pin registered by the coordinate system, a contour map of that same nebula, and we could see where, depending on how the contour lines bunch up, where there are denser and lighter parts, and they are suspiciously stable, and they seem to be getting a little warmer than the rest of the nebula. And we came up with the idea that these could be places where a star cluster might emerge, or at least stars which then become a cluster could emerge. At the same time, on the other side of the science building, astrophysicists were monkeying around with the nuclear theory for how stars shine. This was aided by the release of a lot of the wartime material generated as part of the bomb project. The properties and behavior of atoms and nuclei under extreme conditions of heat and pressure. Well, it was deduced, actually, on the eve of World War II, we had a hypothesis that a cloud of gas made of hydrogen and helium, such as a star. We now knew what a star was. We know that it was a hydrogen globule, globe, sphere, with some mixture of helium in it. Could that ever be large enough to self-contract and make the pressure, density, and temperature in the middle high enough to ignite the burning of, or fusion of, hydrogen into helium? Well, the answer was yes, but then the lid was clamped shut on nuclear research in the universities because it was being taken over for military purposes, not just in the US, but in Europe and in Japan. Prior to the war, Europe, Japan, and the United States freely exchanged information about nuclear behavior as part of the normal free-flowing science dialogue. Once the war came, that was it. In fact, I'll tell you a short story. One of my mentors, Sidney Scheuer in New York, was also a consultant science-wise for science fiction writers. This was before World War II. And for science fiction purposes, one of the stories, or one of the scenarios or plots, would be that a alien society, another planet, invented a bomb which worked by squeezing atoms so tight that they would spontaneously explode all at once. And we called this, the nuclear bomb. And so they were talking about working out a story revolving about this hypothetical product which Sid and other scientists who consulted with science fiction writers, theoretically it's possible, because we can't actually do it, but we know that the energy inside an atom could be released spontaneously at once. Whereas World War II was kind of heating up, especially starting in Europe and not yet in the US, the FBI, Mr. Scheuer, FBI. Okay, let him in. Okay, come on in. Have a seat. We understand that you're talking about a nuclear weapon by which atoms under extreme pressure could split apart and release all its energy as a super duper explosion, am I right? Well, yes, yeah, it's just a made up thing. We know that, you know, that there's an immense amount of energy inside the atom, but it's so tightly held together that we can't get it out. So we invented this idea that people from another planet found a way to split the atom and that energy would come out as an explosive device. In fact, we made some calculations. The energy released would be equal to tens of thousands of tons of TNT. Essentially, about equal to the explosive strength of all the bombs we used in World War I. Mrs. Scheuer, we got news for you. We can't tell you why we're doing this, but we're telling you, stop. Just don't talk about this at all right? Just stop. Because we have intelligence that Germany and Japan have a similar idea. So sure, at first, I'm a patriot and all that. No, wait a minute. If I and, well, we're visiting your other colleagues, don't worry. If I stop talking about this nuclear weapon thing, wouldn't that give a hint to Germany and Japan that, hey, wait a minute, something going on in the United States? Send more spies over there. And the FBI agent said, just keep quiet. We'll come back to you. Mr. Scheuer, FBI. Oh, you came back, yeah. Have a seat. Keep this as a fiction or fanciful or make-believe scenario in science fiction writing. Don't ever give the impression that it actually could be done or that somewhere people are actually working on it. Just keep it as if it was a fictitious weapon. No, keep it low. Keep talking. Okay, whatever you say. So he did. And the rest is history. So, under more extreme conditions, after the war's over, the research and study of atoms acting under extreme pressure, extreme temperatures, was released, declassified, and the academic community, where the work was done anyway, I mean, they had the labs. How does this apply for stories? Well, we can't use the fission method because there are no elements inside a star which could fission. The isotopes that we see in spectrometry do not lend themselves to breaking apart under the conditions inside the core of a star. But hydrogen and helium can, under extreme conditions, squeeze together and make a new element, that is, the hydrogen can make helium, and helium can absorb some hydrogen and make other elements, but that happens in the middle of a star where the pressure and density are greatest. And if the star is more than roughly a tenth the mass of our sun. Now, where could we find in space any object which looks like an agglomeration of sun or more mass and size, which could be contracting and potentially squeezed tight enough to become stars? Well, it would have to be something which is kind of visible, which means it would have to be made of gas and dust. So, go back to those nebulae and see what you can dig up. And something like here in slide 12 emerged, aided by the parallel development, again derived from World War II, of radio telescopes. And moving to slide 13, we see what could very plausibly and casually happen inside nebulae with the general turbulence and tumbling and convection of gas dust. The upper picture shows an illustration of a blob of gas dust which chanced to be denser than the surrounds, and therefore its internal gravity might tend to hold it together against disruption by the gravity field that surrounds it. And in doing so, it would start to compress and compact. So you see three stages of a larger blob of gas dust condensing to a much smaller one. And the lower two pictures show examples. In the left side is a coherent globule called a Bach globule, after the astronomer Bart Bach of the 1950s, who made a careful study of these. And on the right-hand side, another Bach globule against a not-so-luminous background, but distinctly separate from the rest of the nebula. There could be some also attraction of that globule of looser, disorganized gas dust in the vicinity. But for the most part, what was in it to start with, they kind of stayed with it. Now, I'm not going to worry about, oh, is that patch a Bach globule, but this one isn't. No, I'm going to use the terms protostars. So this is a protostar. By the way, besides Bach globule, you may see the term cocoon star, because these are radiating very weakly in infrared because they are warmer than the surrounding gas dust, which is pretty much near the cosmic cold of temperature. And the warmth is presumably, before we figure this out, a star inside that's heating it. Well, there's no actual star inside, but until we realize that the star is still an embryo, we sometimes call these concretions cocoon stars. So nebulae are filled with these here and there, as the beginning of a star's gestation before it is born. Probably none of these can be seen in home-sized telescopes, although we can pick out within the nebulae as deep sky targets parts where they may be found. But these are, although they are large, many times the size of our solar system, at the distance of these nebulae, thousands of light years away, they would not show up for home instruments. Besides the chance accumulation of gas dust into these concretions due to the randomizing movements of the material in the nebula, slide 14 shows two other rather important methods of inducing such concretions. The upper picture shows the Cygnus Loop Nebula. It's a favorite target for imaging in the dark sky regions of the world. It is the remains of a supernova. Now, I don't know if we ever have a record of when it exploded, but from the expansion of the ring of gas dust that we see in that picture, the explosion occurred, you know, tens of thousands of years ago and was for sure not even recognized by primitive societies. But as the supernova shoved its own material out from the explosion, that crashed into the ambient gas dust in the Milky Way. And in doing so, it will compress and induce by shock coalescences of nodules and dense patches of gas dust. And we do find on the outer edge of many remains of supernovae seats of warmer patches or spots, which we, I think, believe were induced to coalesce and collapse and concrete because of the shock that shoved the material together. In the lower left, we have another method, which is a fast-moving star, probably one which was previously formed in another part of the nebula, which is now moving through the nebula and has a shock wave in front. That's what we see there. And that shock wave compresses the gas dust and could trigger coagulation into these little concretions, which are the protostars, the cocoon stars or Bach globules. Several examples of these cocoon stars, protostars, shown in figure 15, are examples from a particular nebula, and these are all infrared pictures. That's why they look like they're shining, whereas the background surrounding material is dark. It's just a contrast effect. An enormous advance in studying star creation, formation, birth, arose in the 1970s with the perfection of infrared astronomy all from the ground. We had a couple of infrared skyrocket, the shot put rocket, but not yet infrared satellites. That'll be coming pretty soon. But from the ground, we found that by going to a elevation above the lower atmosphere and choosing a location of very low humidity. Water vapor absorbs infrared radiation. Actually, it absorbs incoming sunlight, which is re-radiated as infrared radiation, and therefore will contaminate any influx from outer space. But there are some windows where the moisture is transparent through celestial infrared, and through those windows, which are lettered HIJK, I think out to N, or maybe just M, and in some literature you will read, we did these observations in the K band of infrared, whatever, and they represent the zones from the ground, which is a window of a certain bandwidth that we could observe through. So that's how many of these pictures are taken, and we could get better views of these cocoon stars and to some extent peer inside. That is, if the gas dust of the nebula happens to be transparent to a wavelength which also our atmosphere is transparent to, then we can see what's inside that cocoon. But see, you see that there's a scale of distance associated with these, and it gives you an idea that these are huge compared to the solar system. They're large because even though they're concretions and condensations, their density is still, in terrestrial terms, very, very low. They're nowhere great enough to be a core like in the case of a star. Not yet. It's in the process of condensing. Now, the different sizes for these three examples in the target nebula are most likely due to different mass of the concretion rather than stages in time, such that making this all up, the lower left one is an earlier state and the upper right one a later state. I think it's just that the lower left one is a very massive, many, many solar mass globule, whereas the upper left one, upper right one, is more modest in mass. The condensation continues slowly, slowly. Now, as everything in the universe, there's rotation. So there's a net rotation of the globule, and there's also some friction retardation, which homogenizes the rotation to a preferential orientation with rotation axis, and the material starts to flatten out. And at this point, much of the surrounding material has either been flattened out into these disks or has been maybe fluffed away by centrifugal force, because the smaller the concretion, the faster it rotates. It's conserving angular momentum. So the next stage after simply a accumulation of gas dust into a protostar is seen in 16, where you no longer have a disorganized blob, but there is some structure to it, and a hint of a condensation in the center. At this point, the nomenclature shifts to be named after a pair of other astronomers, Mr. or Professor Herbig, H-E-R-B-Bravo-I-G, and Harrow, H-A-R-O, and some of the slides will actually be titled Her Big Harrow Object. That's, in other words, it's the state when you obviously are looking at something which is being differentiated from the gas dust nebula to have its own identity, which has some actual stellar structure. Or so these disc forming features will eventually condense further and further into a nucleus in the middle, which will continue to get warmer and warmer, and material surrounding it as a circumstellar disk. 17, although I don't know for sure who took this, but it's a Hubble-like picture. And actually, as time goes on, we'll be seeing more fantastic pictures like this taken from the ground with telescopes much larger, several meters aperture on the ground with adaptive optics and with far better image processing facilities than what Hubble has. By the way, let me make a note, a news note. Can we have the sound of breaking news? Hubble is in trouble. In 2009, just before the space shuttle was retired, one of its last missions was to do the final repair visit to the Hubble Space Telescope, and part of that chore was remove all the existing gyroscopes and replace them with 6 brand new ones. The gyroscopes are used to spin. They spin on command from the ground in particular sequences, which in reaction the telescope will rotate and track a target. The shuttle was retired, and nothing comparable replaced it. In the interim, until now, 2023, I think actually, 3 of the 6 gyroscopes, and I don't know which 3, but apparently their function, the XYZ orientation, can be selected. So the 3 remaining gyroscopes are locked into the XYZ position. They cannot be swapped off. And that's the last contingency that Hubble can withstand. If a second contingency occurs, that is, one more gyroscope comes out, which it will eventually, and many engineers on the Hubble project think it may happen pretty quickly, then what will happen is they will convert the operation to single gyroscope mode, meaning they will turn off one of the gyroscopes and the telescope will only swing on a specific rotation axis, and the choice of targets will be then targets of opportunity as the telescope can be swept toward it. You no longer can actually aim, but you simply grab what target comes along and see if that is one on the project list which astronomers have put in for. Now, we do have a human capsule replacing shuttle, but does not have the tools to attach to Hubble and do a spacewalk for the replacement. There are other human capsules under design, but they have not been proven out, and they have not been put into flight yet. But if they are, those others will have tools, hardware, which can interface with Hubble and arrange a mission to replace all the gyroscope. But that's iffy. Maybe by 2030 that will happen, and everyone knows that within the next year, this year or 2025, Hubble will slide into single unit mode, and effectively, until the replacement mission comes, will be basically the end of Hubble. Okay, enough of that, and we can go back to our regular programming. All right. 17 shows a close-up of a particular star, SAO catalog star, which has a dust disk around it, indicating that it must be a brand new star made from the knot in the middle of one of those disk protostars. The star itself is masked out because it's overwhelmed the picture otherwise, sort of like looking at the companion Sirius in the glare of Sirius. If you block out Sirius, hide it behind a micrometer wire, you can better easily see the companion. So it's that same technique is done here, and that's the swirling dust surrounding that particular star, and this we believe is a just new star. I don't know where SAO yada yada is, but if you go to an online SAO, Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory catalog, and look up that number, it can tell you the RA declination and maybe even the constellation it's in. The concretion condensation model for the formation of stars also simplifies enormously the problem of how did binary stars form. Now, when I was just entering the profession, the theory was, or the explanation was, well, stars move around in space to have proper motion, and two stars happen to come near each other, and one star grabbed the other into orbit. It sounded good to a grade school student who was just entering the astronomy profession, but later on I and everyone else then realized this would not be feasible. Essentially, in a free fall approach of one body toward another, like a spacecraft toward a planet to do a gravity assist, the energy content of the spacecraft at a certain distance from the planet would be the same as the same distance after passage. You change the direction and you add to it the vector speed of the planet, but you will not get a capture. But in slide 18, we do see how binary stars are being formed inside protostars. In the upper pair on the left, upper left, is a protostar, and there's a concentration in the middle that would be the nucleus ultimately to become a star. But on the right, an enlarged view of that same star, we see that the concretion in the middle is actually two nodules. These are the nuclei which will become two separate stars. And by looking at this over a period of time, we actually do see the rotational orbital motion of those two stars. In the lower picture, that is a single concretion, single cocoon star, actually had two concentrations inside of it which stayed together, and in this case it had a common dust disk around it. In the lower picture we have another scenario where there apparently were two separate stars in the nebula, both with dust disks, but as they came near each other, the dust disks linked together and momentum was dumped by the friction of the material in the gas dust, and we have then a slowing down of the two stars relative to each other such that they will capture into orbit. That's because the momentum approaching was being dumped in the randomizing or the circular motion of the dust disks. The lower right shows a protostar toward the end of its gestation with the two stars about ready to ignite into stars and become a binary star in the sky. The current model for star formation, star creation, also simplifies the problem of where did planets come from. So in slide 19, in the upper picture, upper left, we see a Herbig-Haro object, HHO, and circling it, not only is there the circumstellar disk, but a few globules over on the right, which will never condense into stars, so it's not a multiple star system, and they will be planets. They will be hot Jupiters, perhaps, or simply very large, cold fluff balls, but they'll be cold in comparison to the central star, and they will show phases and shine more or less by reflected light. Incidentally, many HHOs do show polar jets, like noted here. They don't always do that, and if they do, they only last for a millennia or so, because the material to make the jets simply gives out. So it's really the stage to become a HHO is that you actually should show a concretion, obviously of higher temperature and radiance, and surrounded by colder material in a circulating manner. In the lower right, we have a protostar. It's now well separated and congealed, and the disk in this case evolved into a circumstellar ring of cold material, and inside of which could form planets. And in fact, the lower left shows the mother of all circumstellar rings or planetary nebulae with a planet in it. This is Fomalhaut that comes around in the autumn sky and has become a favorite target, especially at public viewings, to illustrate a star with a planet. In fact, some clubs have made a scale printout with a degree scale on it, and when they show Fomalhaut, they say, oh, you see this other star, the other other there, okay, that's a field star. You see this other star down a little lower, that's a field star. But between that second star and about a third of the way to Fomalhaut itself would be the planet if they were bright enough to see. And then the inset in the lower right corner is the actual orbital movement of that planet over a several-year period. And we actually have seen elsewhere protoplanets in the star system with several planets. They look large on the images because they probably are like a cocoon planet. The core in the middle and the stuff on the outside either sift down and consolidate in, or maybe the radiation from the center star will whisk it away. But that is how these protostars and star formation model makes it easier to form planets. See, when I was new to this racket, the going theory was that a star passed near the sun, didn't become a binary star far enough away, but it ripped pieces of the sun off, which being too cold and too small to be stars in their own selves, they cooled off and solidified and became the planets. That method is actually pretty damn difficult to achieve, even in modern computer simulations. This is easy. A quick summary of how to form a star from a nebula is presented in 20, where you go from the upper left, which is the nebula, it's more like the cocoon star already, and then on the upper right, a Herbert Hare object, and they show polar jets. And then you come down to the mid left, and you have the circumstellar disk with the congealing and warming up protostar, and then in the mid right, a star already nice and shining. And the lower two pictures show examples of a single and a binary star essentially igniting themselves to become stars, or just about on the verge of doing so. Now, what makes it a star? Now, in all the stages through now, the radiation out of the star was caused by gravitational or frictional heating of the star. So it's a low-grade warmth compared to a full-fledged star, yet it had become luminous enough, that is, enough of the radiation is in the optical range that we could plot it on the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. They would be marked far to the right side of the main sequence in the HR diagram. Again, if you're a little fuzzy about the HR diagram, go back to the AV files page and pull down the exercise on Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. Look for Russell, it's easier to spell. R-U-S-S-E-L-L. It's the only topic that has that word in it. You also could do a search on the web, which has a lot of very good material on the HR diagram, but here's a warning. If you search for HR plus some other words, you will get hits for payroll, hiring practices, employee benefits, workers' compensation, employee subsidies. So you got hits on human resources. So be sure to include HR diagram, or include astronomical words like star or stellar in the search. So as the star continues to contract and heat, a and remembering that they're fundamentally made of hydrogen with lacing of helium, the point in the life of that star, the gestation period, will come when the temperature and density in the middle will be severe enough to start fusing or melding hydrogen into helium. Now at that point, you have a star ready to be born. Now, the ignition of hydrogen to helium will not occur all at once and puff, now you got a star. It's going to be in fits and starts because the star, although it's compacting, still has some internal movement of its material. So there'll be a extra dense part somewhere and the reactions take place, but then that part loosens up and the reactions die out and they may start in another place. But eventually they will coalesce and the core will become stable and compact enough so it cannot be disrupted by the movement of material inside the star. The result of this is that in the last stages before becoming a star, the star will undergo sputtering or flickering of light output, where it will flash out much brighter when a certain glob inside of it is going through the hydrogen-helium burning, and when that dies out, the star fades, and then maybe another section will pop out. Now, these were noted as variable stars in many of the nebulae, which we now realize are star-forming regions. They were given the catch-all category of nebular variable stars because these behave in such a manner like those only found inside a cloud of gas dust. And the naive supposition was that the flickering and variation was caused by different thicknesses of the nebula which are passing in front of it, the way clouds will cause the sun to brighten and fade as brighter, darker and thinner parts of the clouds pass over the sun. We now know, and that was a very fascinating study that was initiated in 1960, and Sky and Telescope magazine handled recruitment of home astronomers, including myself. There were maybe 1,000 throughout the country, maybe a couple of thousand throughout the world, to study the Orion Nebula, M42. That area was filled with stars flickering in brightness, but they were never studied seriously, that in a coordinated and consistent and continual manner. So my and the other astronomers' tasks, well, we were provided with maps and charts and report forms as often as we could when Orion was in the evening sky. Look at the nebula and estimate the brightnesses of these flickered stars, the ones which are marked and labeled. And when you make the report, you have to note the time to within about 15 minutes, not a day or a fraction of a day. 15 minutes, 1/100th of a day, nearly enough. So we did this. And after a couple of months, we realized that many of the stars which were labeled with a magnitude that we were supposed to use as a comparison, and also many stars which were not labeled at all, were themselves variable. So a lot of us did discover new variable stars in the Orion Nebula. I found one, which I called PAS-1, but it was subsequently given a totally different variable star number. I forget exactly what it is. It's actually on one of the next slides. And others have found them too. So after a couple of seasons, we winded down the project, and the study has been more formalized, and much of it is done at that time using electrophotometry or videography, using, of course, the videotape, or movie film. Actually, in the 60s, video didn't come out yet. That had a ways to go. So today, it's a specialized field of variable star observing. Now, the Orion Nebula is good because it's the closest and brightest and best photographed of all the nebulae in the sky, and because it's close to the celestial equator, it was accessible from both hemispheres, because by the 1950s and 60s we started to develop Hawaii and Chile observatories, and probably put back into operation abandoned observatories in South America. See, so the flicker stars, which is the stage we might find here, was a very important phase which signals to us that these guys in the next millennium will become full-blown stars. Okay, so the star is about to become a regular star, like any other star that you would normally see plotted on the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. One of the most fetching and unexpected results of the modeling of star formation, this molecular cloud, diffuse nebula, whatever you want to call it, the star forming area into protostars and then into regular stars, which I'll tell you very, very shortly, was it explained the reason, the cause for the mass luminosity relationship, which is integral to the study of the HR diagram. But we go to slide 21, and we see in blue the evolutionary tract of a protostar progressing from the right toward the left. And what's happening, you see it's jiggling in brightness, up and down, up and down. This is a illustration. It's not the track of a particular star, but the jiggle simply is a recognition that the brilliance, or the luminosity, is fluctuating pretty much erratically. And in fact, I and the others in that 1960s Orion Nebula project discovered pretty early on that the variation in brightness have time scales, in many cases, of hours. And we found that out because I would see a certain star at a given brightness, and then my partner in another town or another part of the city, he says, no, I was out that night, but I saw a different brightness. And after a while, we realized that he observed 2 hours later than I did, and the star really did alter its brightness enough to notice it and cause a distinct estimate of its magnitude. So we got this little flickering situation. But it's gradually moving to the left, which on the HR diagram, you see temperature at the bottom and luminosity on the left. The star is gradually getting more luminous because there is simply more energy generated in the core as the hydrogen helium processes collect together and become a single nucleus inside the star. When that happens, the star reaches a settlement point on the HR diagram of a specific luminosity and a specific temperature. That is the temperature of this photosphere. It now has a distinct photosphere. It's not the fluff of a nebula surrounding it. But there's more to that. More to that. Each protostar, as it comes out of a nebula, they come in different masses. Some many times the mass of the Sun, some more like the Sun, and others smaller than the Sun. Each one will have a zigzaggy path like this, peculiar to its own individual self, of course, and then it'll move on to the end point where they suddenly stop changing its status and burns as a normal star. And we'll see what happens a slide or two from now, what happens. Well, 22 shows the area around the trapezium, which is a little left down from center, and other stars in the center part of the Orion Nebula. Many of the stars have variable star designation, which is the letter V and a number. And I think I saw one, okay, doesn't matter. I saw one with a double letter. In any case, you have there several stars. This is like a half degree field of view. You have like 10 variable stars in that area, each of them being a protostar, which will eventually ignite into a full-fledged star, like the ones in the trapezium and the one to the upper right, which have to be Theta 1 or Theta 2 or Orionis. Near the top center is a star V1073. That made me famous. It was marked on the original early maps that we had to use as being of 9.9 magnitude, and therefore another variable star which we assessed to be the same brightness as that one, we would mark it down as being 9.9 magnitude. Well, one bright and late evening in the merry month of May, well, not May, because Orion is gone, you know what I'm saying. I, and I think two other people who were observing the same hour block, were making our assessment, and we suddenly saw that their star flare up like a nova, but a flickering, sputtering outburst which stayed there for 15-20 minutes and then suddenly kind of winked out. So obviously I made a note of this, and the others did, and I described it better in the comments column of the report form, sent it in. And then by the correspondence, which at that time was largely by telephone, and my father helped a bit by squeezing in a long-distance call from work, and because he's scientifically minded anyway, he could discuss the project as well as any other ordinary amateur astronomer. At that time they were called amateurs. No more. After Halley's Comet, home astronomers. And so eventually, pretty soon on, that was recognized as a new variable star, the 1073rd found in the Orion constellation. The variable star designations cover the whole constellation, not just the nebula. Another little project you can make for yourself, because the Orion Nebula is photographed, must have millions of pictures of it. Again, you can just pull out every picture you can find of the Orion Nebula and look for the stars within it and see if you can notice that some of them change in brightness from picture to picture. These would be totally uncalibrated pictures, but at least you can tell that that star and that star were the same brightness on this picture, but over here the upper star is obviously brighter. You can do that kind of a thing. Something to do on a rainy weekend. Okay, I mentioned before that each mass of protostar will come to its own stability point on the HR diagram, having a luminosity and a temperature. So slide 23, which is the next to the last slide in this lesson, we see the tracks. They've been smoothed out a bit. The idea is just to show the drift leftward, and at the right margin are the masses for each of those tracks. And then on the track is labeled the period of time, the dwell span, if you will, during which the star converts into a HHO and then ends up as a hydrogen to helium burning star. So first thing we notice is that the more massive the star, those are the tracks at the top, the shorter is the dwell time, or the faster it takes to become a star. The low mass stars, which are the lower tracks, just take a hell of a long time, and in fact there are some stars which are so low mass they actually never become a star. The temperature and densities in the center are simply too mild for the fusion process to take place, and those are the stars which in our century we recognize as brown dwarfs. However, look now at the end points of those tracks. The endpoints define a band in the HR diagram where the stars will now stay there and live out the bulk of their life, like 95% of their life, quietly burning hydrogen into helium. That band is called the main sequence. When our planetarium in New York, the Hayden Planetarium, acquired a new director in the 1990s, when the idea was to replace the existing building with the one that we see there now, that big there, testicle in a lab jar looking structure, the director there came from the Bronx, and he was a very good flourishing astrophysicist. He worked at Columbia and also Princeton, and he, with the museum, set up a graduate school at the planetarium. And we knew him previously because he gave lectures to the old astronomy club, and then he gave lectures at the old planetarium. We knew him. I mean, so he was a friendly kind of a guy. And it was a joke that if the HR diagram was invented by or discovered by him, by the Dr. Neil Tyson from the Bronx, that would not be called the main sequence. What would it be called? Come on, Gary, you know? Okay, you may confer. Okay, what do you say? Grand Concourse. Grand Concourse. Thank you. All right. So the band, I got to use the main sequence because no one else knows the Bronx. The main sequence is the locus where the stars land at birth, so to speak, and they are arranged along that band in order of mass, from low mass at the bottom end toward high mass near the top. Now, a bit of history. Before World War II, we didn't know the full importance of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. It was a convenient way to study populations of stars and to read off assorted properties of stars, but we didn't know why the graph laid out that way. For one thing, there is nothing in the graph which in itself gave the mass of the stars. But during the 1930s, when we have kept accumulating more data about stars, including binary stars, when you plot the binary star components, the A and B components, on the HR diagram, those which fell on the main sequence exhibited a very intriguing property. Now, binary stars are important in astronomy for many reasons. The astrodynamics of the orbit, certainly, and also the life cycle of a star, because as we saw earlier, binary stars tend to form together as a unit, and then during their life as a binary star that you see in the sky as two twinkling points, they look different because they went through the life cycle at different rates. But binary stars are the only direct way, although Gaia Asymmetric Project may find another one, stay tuned. The only direct way of determining the masses of the stars using Newton's revision of Kepler's law. So when we plotted the components of the binary stars, we noted that they were being lined up in order of mass. So the mass-luminosity relation was empirically, accidentally discovered in the 1930s. But no one knew why that happened. The modeling of stellar evolution, beginning in the 1950s, effectively, into the 1960s, gave the answer. The modeling of the stars, different masses of protostar, and using the new electronic computers, which came into use in the 1950s, can do all these crazy calculations, proved that according as the mass of the star, the end point or the stability point of radiant output and temperature would be the same or unique to that mass. Now in this diagram here, we see at the bottom spectral class, a little colored band with the letters in them. They actually map into temperature. That is, the K and M type stars on the right end are cool, which schematically are shown as orange and red, and the left end, O and B, are the hottest stars, shown as blue and blue-white, and the luminosity with the sun as a unit. Which now brings us to the final slide, 24. This is the mass luminosity relation on the main sequence. The other parts of the HR diagram were left out in this illustration. So the giant and supergiant would be in the upper right part, and the subgiants would be parallel to the main sequence on the top, and the dwarf stars would be along the bottom and tacking toward the lower left. So that's been left out. We have the main sequence along which are marked the masses corresponding to the radiance and luminosities. When this was discovered by the plotting of binary stars, the reason they line up was not known. Bear in mind, we didn't fully appreciate the nature of a star until the late 1930s, when nuclear physics advanced to the point and we had enough information and data about the behavior of nuclei to postulate that hydrogen could be fused into helium inside a mass so great that the temperature in the middle would be many millions of degrees, like 15, 20 million degrees at least, and density about a billion or so atmospheres. But could that actually happen inside a star? Well, World War II came, everything was locked down, and when everyone woke up after the war, blinked their eyes, and then the governments dumped into the gutter nuclear research that accumulated during the war. So the universities scooped all this stuff up. Of course, they were doing a lot of the research under contract for us. For instance, if you were at Columbia University, they built a whole new campus in Manhattanville, which is a neighborhood just north of Morningside Heights. They built a whole new campus. But a couple structures which were university properties were kept. One of them on Broadway. You see it from the air as you pass by. Was the first laboratory to test the idea of the atom bomb. And the project was called the Manhattan Project. But during the war, well, very soon after the war, the project got too big. The building just wouldn't hold the equipment, and it was also felt to be too vulnerable to enemy attack from the ocean, because New York City is on the seacoast. The whole shebang was moved to University of Chicago. The building it moved into, which I think was a sports arena, was demolished a long, long, long time ago. But there's a monument at that site which shows that this is where the theory and design of the atom bomb was perfected. And then the whole thing was shipped to New Mexico and put on the test bed, and everyone retreated 100 miles away, the old style of those days, and triggered it, and it worked. See, but the ideas came from just before the war, and now with the release of the nuclear databases and catalogs and experimental results, we could explain the empirical alignment discovered by accident to the necessity of that alignment by the way stars are created. So that is our lesson. Where do stars come from? And don't forget our quiz. You go back to that picture of the Ego Nebula and the pillars of creation. In hindsight, now you know what they are clearly shown in that picture. I'm asking, by using references prior to 1980, because the Ego Nebula was photographed literally 100 years up to that, before then, from the 1890s. We were photographing that stupid nebula over and over and over again. In any of those old pictures, with a poster, a picture book on astronomy, a textbook, a journal article, encyclopedia references, whatever, magazines, could you detect the pillars of creation in any of those pictures? And could you reasonably suppose that the inquiring mind of some astronomer could have said, wait a minute, we gotta take a better look at that thing? So, until next time, pray for clear skies.